And that is the work of the inclusion writer, is literally saying, take a breather, take a step back before you make these decisions, and think about how you have been impacted by the way the industry has lied to you that white is the default for human, and change it up.
Hey everyone, it's Kim, the host of Multiracial White Boy. I'm a mixed transracial adoptee from Vietnam. This is my podcast where I examine the impact of my white upbringing by having personal discussions with other mixed individuals about racial identity in America. That audio clip you just heard, that is from my guest, Fanchen Cox. She's a development executive and producer at Pearl Street Films, and more importantly, the co-author of The Hollywood Inclusion Writer. And a lot of our discussion today centers around the dedicated work she is doing to help the TV and film industry prioritize The Inclusion Writer. For those of you who don't know what The Inclusion Writer is, in short, it is an attachment to a film or television contract which delineates that the project production team must take steps to seek out and hire cast and crew members from historically underrepresented backgrounds. Fanchen is also the co-founder of the Mixed Roots Film and Literary Festival. I've mentioned this remarkable festival several times on the podcast, and needless to say, it is where I met Fanchen. Unfortunately, the festival is no longer around, but I can tell you, in addition to all the great films and great literary works from mixed artists, it was the workshops they had at this festival about racial identity and race in America that still sit with me to this day. And because these workshops were engaging and fearless and disruptive, I wanted this podcast to emulate what I experienced. It's funny looking back, because there's no doubt about it, Fanchen has been extremely influential to me, and she's extremely influential to others in the mixed community, in the Hollywood community, and today's discussion is no different. Just like those workshops that she put on at the Mixed Roots Film Festival, she pulls no punches. This is me and Fanchen Cox.
The idea of pulling no punches is certainly kind of that remains. I think that's probably the most important thing that remains.
Well, that's why I like that. I think that's the only way that we can get to this, because even things on TV with people I admire kind of hold back a little bit when I know they're holding back, and that bothers me.
Yeah, absolutely. You feel it, you see it. And you know, I think we know many of the reasons why sometimes we just have to do that for survival, or, you know, or for money, or for all the reasons.
Yeah, but you're a brand now, you know.
Right. It's, yeah, unfortunately, essentially, it's like, if you want to be in entertainment, you have to acknowledge to a certain extent that it's all about capital. It's branding, it's marketing, it's all of that. So, yeah.
Well, look, I part of the, as much as we do talk about our mixed heritage here, I talk about how it impacts like your sense of belonging in other areas of your life, your sense of self-esteem, your sense of relationships, because it feels like, you know, despite all the systemic things, at least from my own background, it fucked up so many areas of my life that I wasn't aware of. Probably was aware, but more in denial of it, but mostly because I probably carried around with me this sense of white, this honorary status as a white person, as being a transracial adoptee. Absolutely. I really did. I didn't like to admit I was Asian. I didn't like to fucking reveal, tell people I was Asian from my community, even though they knew it. But like, You know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean. I'm thankful. Both of my parents have dementia. And so I'm really
I'm so
lucky
sorry
that,
to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's obviously challenging. And as a filmmaker, storyteller, I'm sure you appreciate how grateful I am that I was able to record them while they were both still, pretty cognitively aware. And it helps me think a lot about my own perceptions and how I identified and why kind of growing up is just hearing from them. Because the truth is, a lot of that is just based on messaging that we got from them and from the world. So that's to say, don't be too hard on yourself about it, because some of this is just plain messaging over and over and over again.
I'm glad you said that, because that's one
automatic.
Of the things I've been dealing. It's totally internalized into self-hate.
Absolutely.
and self-contempt.
That's right. And once you know that, then you could beat yourself up over it if you continue it, right?
That creates suffering. It's one thing knowing it, but when you start to dwell on it, it creates more suffering.
And the oppression of others, right? Because then it's like, you know it and you know what it did to you. But if you then perpetuate that on other people, young people, older people. For me, I'm thinking a lot about colorism now and the ways that, I'm very hard. I do a lot of like hard conversations with white folks around their privilege and the ways that they were given things without merit, or, that merit is a lie because of their whiteness. And it's 100% true for light-skinned people. It's not, we're adjacent, we're white adjacent, but it is certainly, our lives have been, I never call it positively impacted, because it's not positive ultimately for the soul, right? But that we've been given resources, access to resources that we didn't merit, like just purely because of having blue eyes, purely because of having light skin.
That's totally true. But at the same time, like, for example, when I applied for Film Independent, I'm not exactly accepted as a fully Asian filmmaker here. I'm really not. So there's that end of the spectrum too, that like, I'm like,
well,
what?
Did Film Independent see you in your application?
Oh yeah. They saw the running drive. They're great. I love them. But like, I've talked to other filmmakers who were mixed about that, how they, because like maybe they didn't have the enough of an Asian influence, another Black influence, for example, in their family to culturally express those kind of stories. Cause that's, now we're pigeonholing like people like, well, you gotta be this way. And they just want Black stories or Asian stories. And well, like, it's like telling Kathryn Bigelow, she's got to do just chick films the whole time,
Sure. Well, I've got a great story to share with you about that, as a matter of fact. So
I
don't know if
you've
heard of, I'm sure you've heard of the film Passing that's coming out. I think it'll be in theaters.
Or Rebecca Hall did
on Netflix.
Yeah.
Rebecca Hall did it. Right. And it's Tessa Thompson and Ruth Negga, and, both multiracial, mixed roots women. And Heidi Durrow and I wrote the script for Passing back in, because it's an adaptation of a novella, and we wrote the script. We still have the WGA registration of the script that we wrote years ago, like around the time of the earliest festival. So I think in 2012 or earlier, I think we started on a script on a pass at it earlier than that. But so we wrote this script, and I applied to Project Involve with that script as a producer. You didn't have to, apply with the full script, but I talked about my mixedness and how mixedness is exactly what we're saying right now, is an underrepresented story. And I got in based on that. So I think part of the issue is, if we go into Film Independent, and of course things are different now, but
no, you're
if
right.
we go in, right? Like, that we have to acknowledge that our experience is, for me, it is a Black experience, but it's also a privileged Black experience, both because I'm light-skinned and also because of my proximity to whiteness, my white mother raising me. And that is important and interesting storytelling. But if we go in as I'm a Black filmmaker, but my entire film that I've applied with is really truly about whiteness, you know what I mean? Or like not addressing those things, I think that's the issue. And it's exactly what you said at the top of this, is we have to speak fully, truthfully about the complexities of all of it. And then I think people are more open to it. Does that make sense?
It absolutely makes sense. And, you know, oddly enough, you know, I applied with Running Dragon and talked to Francisco. Yeah. And he loved the film there. I was like one of the finalists. But at that time, look, I didn't know if I wanted to be a filmmaker. I just had done that film. That was the first film I did. I was acting and I wrote and directed and it did really well. But at that time, I didn't know what kind of films I did. But since I've been a filmmaker since, though, look, I've had to realize my own issues of like, have I been, look at all the people that have been in my films have mostly been white. Even when I write a script, why can't I envision this person as Asian or Black? Because everything in my life has been of white people. I was writing a film about a guy that, you know, changes up his life by taking a boxing class and does a boxing match, an amateur boxing match. And as a result of having a midlife crisis. And I'm like, why is it? I've never seen this as an Asian guy. I've never seen this as a Latino guy. Only in my head did I envision a white guy like Mark Duplass or something like that, or Paula Giamatti, because that's the only people I've seen.
Because that's fucking Hollywood. Like that is the work that I am now dedicated to doing, is so that we are not all automatically going there, but it's not your fault that you automatically went there. It's not only your upbringing, it's fucking Hollywood that has literally planted seeds in all of us from day one that white male is the default for human being. So when we think human being, we immediately see a white male.
Yeah.
And that's because of Hollywood. It's like and that's why when you have a film like Crazy Rich Asians, it has to be called Crazy Rich Asians and not just Crazy Rich People, right? Or Black Panther, right? It's we have to name it because we are always otherized in Hollywood, versus when they go to pitch a rom-com, they don't have to say it's these two white people that fall in love. No, they just say it's these two people, but then they cast white people, right? So it's something that we all have to constantly push ourselves. So as a development executive now, anytime I get a pitch and a pitch deck, a lookbook for listeners, I don't know if this is the kind of thing you explain, it should explain to listeners, but it's like a PowerPoint.
No. I just gave one to Cindy Cowan's company just a couple of weeks ago.
I'm sure you do. Yeah. And I don't know if your listeners are filmmakers or
most of the people are in the entertainment industry. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. So everybody knows what a lookbook is. So, or a pitch deck. Anytime I get one, I send it back and say, put more dark skinned people in this, whether they're Asian people, whether they're Black people, whether they're even white people, I send it back and I say, there are not enough dark skinned people here. And, you know, then they get it and sometimes they'll Photoshop, make the person darker. And I'm like, no, features and all.
That is so like, wrong.
You know, it's just, we have, and that is the work of the inclusion writer, is literally saying, take a breather, take a step back before you make these decisions. And think about how you have been impacted by the way the industry has lied to you that white is the default for human, and change it up. Before you send out your pitch deck, change the faces to something you never thought of. And then to your point about experience, we want to be seen as human beings. Your boxer film should have a dark-skinned Southeast Asian person in it and still be exactly the same film. It's not that you have to change anything about it, because we are humans too. This is a film about a human being, a universal experience. Then just make that person look different, but everything else is the same.
Everything else is going to be the same. Yeah.
Because we're people.
Yes. Okay. Look, I want to pivot back to where it all began in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Okay. Your father was, what is Pan-Africanist? I know he's Jamaican. I remember your father, you told me your father was Jamaican, but you had Pan-African.
That's right.
Your mother was Northwesterner. So talk about your father real quick.
Sure. My dad is Jamaican, born and raised in Jamaica, but he's a Pan-Africanist, which means that he believes that all peoples from Africa should be unified in their, you know, kind of in the struggle against racial oppression, in, you know, politics and everything. So because of the diaspora, because so many of us were displaced from the original home of Africa, he believes that, and Pan-Africanism believes that all of us who were removed should unify around the injustices we suffered, but also the joy and the, you know, all the benefits of having been where we're from. So it's more an ideology. Jamaica is his kind of geographical heritage, but the Pan-Africanism is an ideology.
Growing up in Boston, being mixed, did you grow up in a predominantly white community?
I was really lucky to end up in Cambridge, which is about 5 minutes outside of Boston, when I was nine, because I was born in DC, which was at the time called Chocolate City. And so I was the very light-skinned girl, you know, of a Black parent and a white parent. Then when my parents divorced, my mom moved us around a couple times, and both of those places we moved to were very white. I say in the show, so we one of those places was Strong, Maine, where the population was 400 and the Black population was exactly one, which was my half and my brother Winston's half. And that's where I learned the N-word. That's where I learned that we were ugly and that we were, you know, wrong for having a Black parent. And then fortunately, my mother got a job in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which was multi-culti heaven, where, you know, my fellow students were named Sunshine and Freedom and two moms, two dads, and lots of mixes. That's where I learned the word mulatto, and where I learned learned biracial and these kinds of terms. But we were embraced there, and I would say, and I know you've experienced this, not just embraced, but actually kind of uplifted, which as an adult I have seen as problematic. But there we were the special kids. We were the, you know, you're going to save the world, this, you know, because of your racial mix, and oh, you're so beautiful, and you got good hair, and you got good eyes, and, you know, all of that kind of messaging that is actually really dangerous for young mixed kids to get. But as you know, and you've talked about already, on a self-esteem level, there's nothing like getting positive messages when you're young, because it means you feel good about yourself and you can go on to be successful, versus your darker skinned family members or darker skinned friends or Black friends or Asian friends who aren't getting those same messages. And so.
But you were still informed earlier that you were, you know, essentially the N-word. But even though you go to another place, you still have that feeling that you're walking, you're going in and out of spaces, and you're still that person that someone had told you were.
I credit both parents. I mean, I'm glad you asked about Pan-Africanism, because one of the things that Pan-Africanism does is to enforce and reinforce loving Blackness, loving Africanness, loving being Pan-African. And so fortunately, however my parents did it, before we ended up in Maine, we got messages to love being Black. That was in Chocolate City in DC. That was from a dad who was Pan-Africanist. That was from a mom who also loved Blackness. Fortunately, once we got to Maine, we had already been given those messages. So once we got there, I knew that I literally remember being like, oh, you're the fucked up one, you know, and that, thank God, right? Because I know not everybody, or thank my parents, I should say, not everybody gets to feel that when they first are called the N-word. They might internalize it and believe it, whereas I knew they were in the wrong.
I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
Like growing up in the white family, when I got like all, and we'll talk about more of this later in terms of white supremacy, all like the predominantly white community would always fuck around and joke around with me, call me nippy, gook, but it was like, but I rolled with it.
Right.
And I had a girlfriend that said something really interesting to me. She's like, why would you be affected by that when you didn't know what it was like to be Asian? I was really only affected by it because I knew the difference when they would joke around and then when they really tried to dig deep with it and fuck with me.
And there was a difference. There was a difference.
Major difference with it. And I think having a parent, having someone throw you a book, having a mentor is super important. I didn't realize that they're the ones that are fucked up. Like you're not to blame here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's part of why entertainment calls me so much, because we have this responsibility for planting seeds early on in kids' heads, right? Like they are watching and being, you know, creating their perceptions of who they are from what they see. And we have this opportunity to let them know, like we have the little Kims and little Fanshans of the world, so let them know, you know what? You know, you're good and they're wrong. You know, they're the ones that are wrong. They're the ones that are spiritually all kinds of fucked up, you know, and actually hate themselves. But I always, yeah, I mean, I wondered for your experience, because of course also there's the being transracially adopted. And I do, you know, a lot of DEIA workshops. And the first part of the workshop is to examine our first names and how they're connected to our racial identity, our class identity, our gender identity, and yours is, there's so much there.
I mean, look, the only, like, I'm not so, you know, on board with the whole gender thing. It's not threatening me, but I don't care. But look, the whole gender name pronouns really works in my favor when I send out emails now.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, but, and that's, the thing is, like, we didn't have any control over the name we were given, right? Once we're 18, we can legally change it. But even the fact that we would have to legally change it already means we've been kind of saddled with this oppression, you know, based on what somebody else chose for us. And so even in the case of someone who is adopted, it's even more so, right? Because it wasn't even your, you know, your birth parents, potentially the name you have wasn't even your birth parents' choice for you. And so this says a lot about how the world perceives you and then therefore how you perceive yourself. And it's just another example of something that I think we don't think about enough, that we have to kind of place in this category of, these are all these messages that we're getting from other people all the time. And how do we, on one hand, say to ourselves, like, we love ourselves, we love our names, right? But also fight against all that messaging that we're getting. I don't know. It's challenging.
It is challenging, because if there's one thing I've gotten out of these conversations that I've had from doing the podcast, and that I'm learning from, is erasure. Like you're just saying, the name. I was given a Vietnamese name, but then an American name. And
so what is your Vietnamese name?
It's Linh Phi Long, and it means running dragon. That's why I got
Oh, that's right. That's right. Did you talk about that in the film?
I did. I named it Joe Christmas because that was a character from a Faulkner book, Light in August. Where the guy, no one knew the guy was black. He was accepted as a white person, basically.
Right.
So with all your experience, you know, with your family, your father, Mixed Roots Film Festival, why'd you create it? You're the co-creator. Mm-hmm. What inspired you to create it?
Yeah, at that time, I understood that this was an undertold story. I mean, speaking of making sure people see themselves, especially when they're younger and, because we're so deeply influenced by the images and the stories, I just felt strongly that we should create a space. And we started with the podcast Mixed Chicks Chat, and you know, within months of doing, probably the first month of doing it, we were like, we need a broader arena as well. We need a visual arena for these stories. And so it really was, and continue my goal in life continues to be to uplift stories that we haven't been able to see, and because it's so important. So it really was that. It was knowing that I couldn't find my story anywhere. And as we had guests on the podcast, we were like, these stories should be told. Kids should hear them. Families should hear them. I will say that I've learned a lot, and I wouldn't start one today for sure.
What did you learn the most?
I think what I learned the most, and this is an unfortunate thing, like a challenge still for me this day, is how steeped we are in the mixed community, and now I even use air quotes sometimes, in whiteness and white supremacy and that ideology. And that's why I started to kind of separate myself from that community, or actually, much to the chagrin of the community, not separate myself, but go in and critique all the time, right? Like,
Fanshan, every person that has come on this podcast, I would say a good 80% of them have kind of pivot and shift over to whiteness because it was safer. That's why I started this thing.
I know.
So you found that to be problematic in the community, in the mixed community.
It's deeply problematic.
Oh boy. What about even with this new generation of kids?
They're different, and we should all pat ourselves on the back. They're different because we started talking about that you can't separate mixedness from white supremacy, and white supremacy is inherently evil. And so there's an aspect of our identity that is rooted in evil. It's like, there's no other way to say it. I'll tell you. So one of the things that really kind of gets me on my soapbox is when a mixed person says something along the lines of, well, you know, I'm proud of my Black identity. I'm proud of my Asian identity. Can't I be proud of my white identity too? And the answer is absolutely not. Because if you understand the historical context of how white identity was formed, there is nothing to be proud of. You might be proud of being Danish or Irish or whatever those kind of heritage, you know, the heritage, the European heritage of how folks immigrated here and what happened when they immigrated. But white in and of itself was literally created for the perpetual oppression of anybody who was lied to and told they weren't white, because it's a lie, right? And we can go into why it's a lie. It's a lie, and it is the worst kind of lie. Because it is a lie that was used for genocide, for the conversion of Native people into Christianity. Like, it is a lie. And so anybody who is proud of that identity, it's a little bit scary, honestly. It's Proud Boys. They are proud of that identity.
Yeah. And it, what you just said reminded me of an essay that James Baldwin wrote. And he talked about why he never understood why, at what point did so many Danish people, German people, Swedish people move to America and then start calling themselves white?
Yeah.
Like,
but we know we have
to call ourselves Asian, and you have to call yourself Black, and but they don't get a call of them that they don't get a, like, they've kind of removed their heritage.
Absolutely. Like, and that's the thing, is that not only is, you know, white identity this real horrible thing, it is also, it's not just horrible against those who are not white, it is also like spiritually bad, because it has stripped you of your actual heritage, right? Your actual history that you should know about it. Now, the truth is there's some bad shit there too. Like, you know, I mean, like the Vikings were really also quite evil, right? Or Christopher Columbus, Italian, you know, like, you also have to own the colonial aspects of Portuguese identity and, you know, European identity, but at least you have more than just white. And white is literally, do you know about the Takao Ozawa case, the Supreme Court case in the 1920s? Do you know about
No, I do not.
Man. So in the 1920s, in order to become a naturalized citizen, U.S. citizen, you had to prove that you were white. So I'm gonna say it again.
Was this where the one drop came in? And when it was slavery?
I thought no,
it
was, no, no. This is
really
the
1920s. Okay. Go on, keep
this
going.
Is literally as recently as the 1920s. So there was no enslavement. There was, you know, Jim Crow was starting to, certainly it was, you know, still
it's rearing its ugly head post kind of Reconstruction. Yeah.
Yeah. This is the 1920s. And when I tell people this, they don't believe it. You, in order to become a naturalist, so if you were Vietnamese and moved to this country, let's say you immigrated here for school and you were here long enough that you decided you wanted to become an American citizen, the only way you could do that is that you had to prove that you were white. So wrap your head around that already. Okay. Now, there were concessions, of course, for people of African descent, because they brought us here and they're like, how do we deal with this? Right. But if you came here from another country, so Takao Ozawa is a Japanese man. He comes here from Japan to go to school. He went to Berkeley, goes to Berkeley, ends up getting married, has kids, loves being American. He lives in a all white neighborhood, goes to all white church, doesn't allow his
completely
family.
Completely assimilates himself like we all do.
100%, right? Doesn't allow anyone to speak Japanese at home, nothing. Fully assimilated. And he decides that he wants to become naturalized as a US citizen. He's very proud of it, he wants to be. He gets his case all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States, and the Supreme Court of the United States denies him citizenship because they say that the scientists are very clear that you have to have heritage from the Caucasus mountain region in order to be considered white. That's where the word Caucasian comes from. It's a pure lie. Because there is no scientific evidence that that's what Caucasian or white is, because there is no such thing. But in the 1920s, they deny him his US citizenship because they say, the scientists say, you're not white. Then 3 months later, Bhagat Singh Thind, who's an Indian man born in India, he's watching this case because his case is coming up before the Supreme Court. And he is born in that region. So where he's from is part of the Caucasus mountain region. It's only 3 months later, and he's wealthy, and he served in the military here. So he's like, I can definitely, and in India, I am white because he's got money. So he's here. It's 3 months later. His case goes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court denies him his citizenship, saying in this case, science is no longer relevant. And instead, we're going to rely on the common man. And the common man knows you're not white. So our immigration laws are based on the lie that the Supreme Court says they know they can say what white is, even though it's not based on science and it's not based on the common man, because within 3 months, they flipped how they created that category in the first place.
Okay, so none of us learned anything in our history classes.
That's why.
And I wanted to talk to you about essentially white supremacy, because, you know, I feel like we spend a lot of time talking about how it impacted Black people, yet we never discuss the role of how white supremacy created it.
Absolutely. Right. It created all of the racial categories. It's right. It's the way I say it is, racism created race, not the other way around. So there is no such thing as race. It's not real. And trust us, we know every white supremacist scientist has tried their very best to prove that there is such thing as race. There is no such thing as race. It's a lie. Racism birthed it. Racism birthed it based on capital, right? Like, how are we going to divide these people so that one of these people will in perpetuity work for free? And these other people will encourage that so that they don't have to work for free, right? Like, it was a division that was created thinking that they could look at you and determine what you were. And that's a lie too, right? But that, so it created those. However, the way I think of Blackness, the way I think of like AAPI identity, is that it is real because it is based on resistance to white supremacy. And that is a real thing. That's a cultural, that's a ethnic, that is a, you know, tradition. So things that we do in the name of being Black or in the name of being Asian are in resistance to white supremacy.
Makes sense, but it feels like when people come here, there is less resistance, like the example you gave about the guy that was denied his citizenship in the 1920s.
Yeah. You mean in what sense?
In the sense that they come here and we become assimilated.
We let go, right.
We let go. And I feel like because, like you mentioned with mixed people, they eventually move over to whiteness because it's a sense of feeling American, and you don't have to, there's less struggle that comes with it. There's less challenges that come with it. And let's put it honestly, there's more privilege that comes with it. It becomes a proud boy mentality.
Exactly. That's the thing. And look, I would hope that I even, you know, in enslavement times, I know that I would have been a house slave, right? Without question, I would have, you know, and I would hope that at that time I would have resisted that, but I don't know. If I had children and wanted to protect my children, would I have chosen to tell my children they were white so that they could live a better life? Honestly, I don't know. All I know is that today, I could still pass if I wanted to, and I resist that. My life would be a lot easier if I didn't spend my all day every day pushing back against Hollywood, pushing back, right? Like, my life would be easier, but I couldn't live with myself. So I think that's what we have to think about. You know, like, what messaging are we sending to assimilate in that way, or to let go of the beauty and the power of embracing our Asianness, our Blackness, our, you know, our brownness? What are we giving up for ourselves and for the future in doing that?
Speaking of white males. You work for two of the most powerful ones in Hollywood.
I work with, not
you
for.
Work with. Thank you for reframing that. Thank you for reframing that. So I heard, because I got the backstory. So I'm going to go into something real quick.
Oh,
so
boy.
I met a friend of yours. We actually went on a date on Tinder.
Shut up.
A long time ago. And it was, her name was Amy. And for some reason we...
Did she work for George Clooney?
No, her name was Amy Gray. I think her name was.
And
she told me that you guys all came here from Boston to act.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not know that was your connection. And I was like, that you guys all lived together here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
And I just was like, oh my God, I want to be a fly on the wall in that apartment that you guys all live together.
Okay.
So now that you work with them.
Yeah. But I have to give a little, can I just give a little context very quickly?
Sure. Please. Please do.
So we all grew up doing theater together. That's why we became close. When you do theater, you know, you're together all the time.
And this is in Cambridge.
In Cambridge, Massachusetts. Matt and I met when we were 9 because our older brothers were best friends. And so we would tag along with
I thought it was Ben was first. Okay, got it.
No. So
Matt was
Ben's
first.
Younger. Exactly. So Matt and I were in elementary school together. And then when we went to high school, Ben came to our high school and he became part of the theater program. So I think we were sophomores when Ben came. And then we all became close and other people who don't have their same names, but are certainly doing well in the industry, like Max Casella, who was Max Deitch at the time. He's an actor that does really well. He was part of this. And Matt Mayer, who's doing, like, we have a decent group of people that did well. They didn't do Matt and Ben well, but they did well. Matt and Ben then before finishing college, moved out to Hollywood. I had a very different trajectory. I didn't move out here till 01, but when I moved out here, I stayed with Ben. That wasn't an apartment at that point. That was a mansion.
Okay. So I got just a little piece of the context from
Eagle Rock. You know, they lived in Eagle Rock.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's what I had heard from the person from Amy.
From Amy. Yes.
So yeah, who is a lovely person, by the way.
She is. Yes.
So in working with them,
mm-hmm.
is there anything that you've had to teach them, talk to them about in regards to diversity? As much as I think they're open-minded and they seem like very decent human beings and individuals and very educated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think where I'm really fortunate in the relationship is that we all grew up together in a city that prides itself on its diversity and equity and inclusion. And it still does. It's this wonderful city. One of our teachers who was integral to all of our lives and really helped us become storytellers, died about a week ago. And so I put together a tribute video. This was a Black queer man, dark-skinned Black queer man. And he was extremely influential to us in who we became. And our school we had lots of Black queer folks and people with disabilities. And this is what our theater department looked like.
And this was back in Cambridge, the instructor that you guys had?
Yes. He was our English teacher, our high school
that's
English.
So great.
And he was just truly an incredible person. I'll send you the video link because it's him speaking and you can see just what an influence he had on all of us. And so that's the atmosphere we grew up in. Cut to Good Will Hunting, where they depict Boston they depict Boston as a very white city. And even when they put people that we know into the film, like our drama teacher, like Casey, Ben's younger brother, none of them were of color. None of them were our LGBTQ friends. None of them were, you know, the rest of what we had exposure to growing up. At that time, nobody was thinking like that. We should have been, but we weren't. We were just like, let's get this movie done. And yes, it's about these guys in South Boston, and South Boston itself is very white. But they could have done better, and they should have. And then they spend 20 years in the industry continuing to perpetuate the idea that white is the default for human being. Look back at all of their films, and they're all overwhelmingly white, cast and crew. And they didn't stop and say, this is not even our experience. This is a lie. This is not what the world looks like. We've got to make and insist that their films and their projects actually look like what the world looks like. And I know personally that they had that example. And our drama teachers were so wonderful that Matt and Ben and me, a few of us were like, we're actors, even when we were 13, right? Like, and Matt one time made himself sick on a role. He got mono because he was so, you know, he was so intense about getting this role, right? But what they would do, our teachers would do, is they would give us the like three lines in a play, and then they would go cast from the football team. Or they would go cast from the math club. They would pull kids from the community into our place. And these kids were not white and blonde haired and blue eyed. So that's what we grew up with. So then to spend 20 years in the industry and not stop and say, wait a minute, this is not, we are perpetuating this messaging. That's the conversation we have a lot and continue to have. And that's what led to the creation of the inclusion rider for them was, we can negotiate in our contracts and say, this is important to us, cast and crew, that it looks like what the world looks like.
Okay, so I want to talk to you about the diversity, the least that I've seen since George Floyd. Mm-hmm. Tell me if I'm in the wrong here, but it seems like since George Floyd, the casting that I see is either black and white mm-hmm. on commercials or mm-hmm. in film, or it's the same stories we're still seeing, but all the secondary parts are token BIPOCs, mm-hmm. which only leads me to believe that they're still secondary to white people.
Absolutely.
Is that kind of fair to say?
100%. So
why is it considered diversity then? Like, so why have all this diversity when where the secondary parts are Absolutely. Minimal. Right. They're just secondary parts.
Absolutely.
But putting them in there, they're feeling like, oh, we got a quota done today.
Exactly. I mean, because, and I have to say, I have to bring this back to the inclusion rider. What the inclusion rider does is it's not just enough to say, we're going to, you know, now we're going to cast these people in this film and then you're done. What the inclusion writer says is you have to actually make specific targets and benchmarks around how your hiring is going to look. And then you have to collect and analyze the data and report it back out. And where you fell short in helping to push the industry in the direction you say you want it to go in, where you fell short, you have to pay money into the organizations that serve to uplift the filmmakers that you've couldn't find to hire, because the accountability is key. What's happening is they keep getting away with it. They say Black Lives Matter all last summer, right? They put their black squares up. They say, well, I mean, look at Squid Game, right? Like, you couldn't have a more clear example of the fact that Asian leads will kill it, right? And same with Crazy Rich Asians. Like, we now have clear examples that y'all been lying. First of all, y'all been lying to us this whole time, saying that you couldn't sell our movie with us as leads in it. So y'all been lying. And there is no reason to continue doing this. But when you do, we're going to hold you accountable for it. That's the difference. That's why with Harvey Weinstein finally going to prison, because we finally held him accountable. That led to now all of these women and other folks saying, I don't have to put up with this. I don't have to deal with the casting couch. I don't have to deal with this. I can talk to somebody about this, but only because we held him accountable. We have to hold Hollywood accountable for the ways that they keep perpetuating it. So I'm glad you talk about it. We should all keep talking about it. We should call it out every time we see that now we're still relegated to the, you know, to the help, to the, you know, to the stereotypical roles that they want to give us. No, don't stand for, we should not stand for that.
To add to that.
Yeah.
To what you just said, John Gruden, who I really liked as a NFL coach, as an NFL commentator, with the recent emails that just came out with everything he did, he's going to get hired again because he's a valuable commodity in that industry. So even though he was fired, I kept thinking, like, what is a system that can, is there any possible way to create a system of accountability other than just firing people that makes people that, because we want to give people a second chance, I believe. I really do. I want to give people a second chance, because, but I want it to be on the condition that they learn something from it, that they were accountable to themselves.
Yeah.
Because, or else I feel like we're just going to be in the same cycle of this repeating itself.
Yeah, I agree. And I, yes, the accountability matters. You know, we saw it with Jeopardy also, right? When they hired this white guy to, you know, become the host. And then these, I don't know if it was social media or emails came out and there was enough of a, you know, of pushback for him to eventually step down. And I mean, the thing is, Kim, like, I agree. I'm not down with cancel culture in the sense of completely giving up on a person's ability to grow and change. Like, because I want that opportunity, as we said here. If you base what you believe about me on what I used to say on the Mixed Chicks Chat podcast, or what I used to believe for Mixed Roots, and without critically thinking about the white supremacist aspect, if you cancel me for that, you wouldn't have given me the opportunity to grow to where I am now. So we have to have the opportunity to grow, but all too often, folks did not grow, like, and especially white folks and especially cis men, because the system tells you you don't have to, right? We're still in that place where you really don't have to. So you getting the consequence of him getting rehired is not only that then we perpetuate this message that he can do that and harm people by his words and still get hired, but it also means that other person who was just as capable and should have been, if it weren't for racism and sexism, et cetera, should have been in that position, also loses out on that position. So it's double. It's double. It's not just what's, oh, what about him? It's also, what about all the people who didn't, who should have been hired, who were, look, the truth is, as folks of color in the industry, especially, we work our fucking asses off. Let's be real. We run circles around the white folks because they only have one job, which is to be themselves. We got to be good at our jobs, and we got to deal with racism and sexism, et cetera, all day, every day. We run circles around them.
But what's the resistance you're getting from white people now? Because, like, under the Real Talk, when I have my white friends, they all kind of feel like, even though none of them have technically been threatened.
Oh, yeah.
By anything,
I'm going to lose my job. I can't get work anymore.
Yeah. They all feel threatened.
Exactly.
And I'm like, have you seen the statistics of white people in this industry? You are overwhelmingly doing great.
Our great, great grandchildren won't see the day that they, maybe them, right? It's so overwhelmingly white that they are fine. They are just fine, right? So I mean, I don't know, what was the question, like what to do about it or what to say?
Wasn't
the resistance. I'll tell you one of the points of resistance. So there's always an excuse, right? The current excuse is we're too busy with COVID to think about diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? Like this is now, because we're bringing the inclusion rider in as early as the development process. We're like, the minute I get a show creator come to me and say, you know, start to get a shopping agreement with them, I say the inclusion rider is part of this agreement. Like we are not going to make this with you without the inclusion rider. And that tends to be okay with the show creator. When we start to bring on a production company, the production company then says, but we've got so much to do with COVID. We just can't add these measures in. Motherfuckers, yes, you can. You're showing us you can because of what you've done with COVID. The way folks have bent over backwards, as they should, for COVID measures, they could have been doing that all along for diversity, equity, and inclusion. They didn't.
That's a great point. They could do anything they want to drop of a hat if they make it, if they make it a priority.
Exactly. And so
COVID, which is an emergency.
And this is an emergency.
And this is somewhat of an emergency because it's more than just work and
it's
needing the
impacting the world.
It impacts us.
See, yeah. Little Kim and Little Fanchon were impacted deeply by the messages we got from Hollywood. It's an emergency. It's a fucking emergency. It's been an emergency.
When you tell people it's an emergency and emphasize the importance of it, especially where you are now among a group of white men or white women, to be quite frank with you, as well, who kind of like, you know, what Audre Lorde said, you know,
worse.
They don't want to lose their privilege either. So how do I say this gently, man? And how do you navigate the room without and thoughtfully communicate with them this sense of importance of diversity and inclusion and the inclusion rider without making them feel threatened? Does that make sense?
It does. It makes total sense. They're going to feel threatened no matter what. As you said, you've got your...
It's almost like you got to be like, get over it. They're going to feel threatened. Just say it. Like, how do you approach it?
You try different tactics with different... You read the room. You read the room. You've got the, you know, there's some of them are, you know, white, like folks from Cambridge have believed all along that they were this wonderful multicultural city, you know, but if in reality, if you look at the fact that Matt and Ben were the ones to become successful when we had this incredible wealth of talented people, but the two white guys were the ones that got an Oscar and that are, you know, multimillionaire celebrities. That means we did some things wrong too, right? That means that community that believe, but that's a community where you can critique that openly. Whereas other, you read the room and you figure out what's the in with you? What's the in with you? The truth is, no matter who it is, they're gonna be fragile. So the first thing I always do is point out what they're going to start feeling and doing when I bring this up.
That's really smart, because then you're just like, you're preparing them for it.
Exactly. I literally say to them, here's what you're going to start to feel as you feel, you're going to feel racialized maybe for the first time in your life, because you've been told you're just a human being, but actually you're white and that means something. So you're going to start to feel embarrassed, scared, angry, upset. You're going to feel like you want to get up and leave. You might cry. Those things are all going to happen to you. And it's all because you are being asked to think differently around race. The other thing I point out is I love this thing called standpoint theory, it's a feminist theory, but it applies so well to everything we're talking about. Standpoint theory is that the more marginalized you are, the broader view and therefore perspective you have. Because when you're marginalized, in order to survive, you have to understand all of the perspectives that go narrow from your broad perspective, right? In order to live your daily life, we and James Baldwin talks about this, the enslaved had to read and understand the slave masters in order to survive. But the slave master never had to understand the slave. So we understand you. We have our PhDs in you and in racism. You are preschoolers because you've never felt racism one day in your life. It wasn't created for you. You might feel discrimination, you might feel hurt, those things, but you will never feel racism. So if a person of color tells you that you've done something racist, you are in kindergarten. They have their PhD. Who should you believe, right? So you prepare them with that they're going to have to be in a position for maybe for the first time in their lives to accept that they don't have the answers. They have zero answers.
Have you been in a room where they're like, I'm okay that I don't know? Where they're open to it, and where you're surprised, you're like, whoa, I didn't see this coming.
Yes. And they also still always get fragile at some point. Mm. So I've learned not even to get too excited when they go, oh my God, ding.
I'm eternal optimist.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm learning because then I go, oh good, my work is done here. I'm going to move on. And then they come through with the next thing. And I'm like, motherfucker, didn't you just say, you know?
Oh boy. Okay. I want to end the podcast.
Okay. Yeah.
With this. What do you feel optimistic about in regards to the inclusion rider work you are doing?
I feel very optimistic that we are finally in a place where we're going to be able to start to measure the impact of the fees that have to be paid when the productions don't meet their targets. So it has taken us 5 years to get to this place where we can start to be able to measure the fee part, the fee structure where they give back into the organizations. And so I'm really optimistic because I'm confident that that is making a difference. It's not everything. It takes a village, right? But I'm confident that we can show that the inclusion rider has had an impact in that way, and I'm excited about that.
That was Fanshan Cox, everybody. Thank you so much, Fanshan, for coming on the podcast. I can't tell you how awesome it was catching up with her, man. It had been a long time. You know, we're on Facebook together, but it's just not the same when you get to sit down and talk to someone about something they're really passionate about, educated about, and their knowledge just empowers you. Okay, everybody. Once again, I'm Kim, the host of Multiracial White Boy. Please remember to subscribe to the Multiracial White Boy podcast. And also, if you can, please, it means so much to me and the mixed community, leave a review. Let us know what you think. Thank you, everybody. New podcast episode drops next Tuesday. As usual, tune in. Have a great week. Be safe.